to me as I talked to the Klebolds that Sue was Germany and Tom was Japan. Sue was intensely introspective and burdened with terrific guilt, while Tom proclaimed that it was horrible and then tried to move on. "What are you going to do?" he said. He felt that he had a reason. He suffered the ultimate. He's no longer here. "I'm sorry for the pain my son caused other people, but we had more than our share of pain in this, too. We lost our son. Then we had to live with his memory being attacked." Like Japan, he also externalized the causes, but only to a point. I imagined Eric telling him, "If you don't do this, I will come and kill your parents," Tom later said. But Dylan's willingness to participate is inescapable. Sue believes that Dylan would have been able to foil pressure from Eric if that had been the pivotal factor. She has wondered whether he might have endured some precipitating trauma, even if he'd been raped by someone, but has never found any evidence to that effect. In writings that go back to his sophomore year, she said, "He talks like a thoughtful, introspective, depressed kid, mostly about how he has a crush on somebody and she doesn't know he's alive. 3 months before the tragedy, he's talking about how he wants to die, and he says, 'I might do an NBK with Eric.'" She learned that NBK stood for Natural Born Killers. So as late as January, Dylan hadn't really decided that he was going to do this. He just wanted to die. But why blow up the school? I get in my car on a Monday morning, and I start thinking about Dylan, and I just cry all the way to work. I talk to him, or I sing songs. You have to be in touch with that sorrow. An event of such enormity completely disrupts one's sense of reality. "I used to think I could understand people, relate, and read them pretty well," Sue said. "After this, I realized I don't have a clue what another human being is thinking. We read our children fairy tales and teach them that there are good guys and bad guys. I would never do that now. I would say that every one of us has the capacity to be good and the capacity to make poor choices. If you love someone, you have to love both the good and the bad in them." Sue worked in a building that also housed a parole office and had felt alienated and frightened getting on the elevator with ex-convicts. After Columbine, she saw them differently. "I felt that they were just like my son, that they were just people who, for some reason, had made an awful choice and were thrown into a terrible, despairing situation. When I hear about terrorists in the news, I think, that's somebody's kid. Columbine made me feel more connected to mankind than anything else possibly could have." The Klebolds had letters from kids who idealized Dylan, and from girls who were in love with him. "He has his own groupies," Tom said with an ironic half-smile. They were heartened by unanticipated kindnesses. At a conference about suicide some years later, a man came up to Sue, knelt in front of her, and said, "I just want to tell you how much I admire you. I can't believe the way you have been treated. Every day I picked up the paper, and I expected to read that people were coming up your driveway with pitchforks." Sue has had strangers hug her, but the prospect of a normal life remains elusive. She recounted a recent trip to the supermarket, when the checkout clerk had verified her name on her driver's license. And then she says, "Klebold, did you know him?" And I say, "He was my son." And then she started in with, "It was the work of Satan." And I'm thinking, "Please, let's bag the groceries here." As I leave the store, she's yelling out after me about how she's praying for me. It wears you down. Before I went to meet Tom and Sue the first time, a friend asked me whether I was afraid of the Klebolds, as if I might succumb to some contagious evil in their house. Ultimately, what proved difficult to reckon with was their underlying normality. One of Dylan's friends said that he used to call them Ward and June after the sunny couple on Leave It to Beaver, because their household seemed so pleasant and predictable. They showed me family photo albums and home videos. I was particularly struck by a video of Dylan on his way to his prom, 3 days before the massacre. He's a little churlish in the mode of adolescence, but also has a sweetness about him. He seems like a nice kid. It would never have occurred to me that he could be on the verge of wanton destruction. His long hair pulled back in a neat ponytail, he's adjusting his rented tuxedo and complaining that the arms are a little short, smiling while his date puts on his boutonniere. "Dad, why are you filming this?" he asks. Then he laughs and says, "Well, someday I'll watch it again, and I'll wonder what I was thinking." It was impressive dissembling, because he imparts the feeling of someone who will one day remember being dressed up with a pretty girl on the way to the biggest party of his life. Near the end of the video, he says, "I'll never have kids. Kids just mess up your life." The sudden angry moment comes out of nowhere and evaporates just as fast. From the day of the bloodbath, April 20th, until the following October, the Klebolds knew few details about what had transpired, except that Dylan was at the shooting and supposedly committed suicide. "We kept clinging to the belief that he hadn't really killed anybody," Sue said. Then came the police report. "It just launched my grief all over again, because I didn't have denial anymore. They could talk about which people he'd killed. Here's the little map of the school, with all the little bodies on it." Then they saw the basement tapes which Dylan and Eric had deliberately left behind, which reveal a Dylan unrelated to the young man in the prom video, someone spewing hatred, full of self-aggrandizing rage. "Seeing those videos was as traumatic as the original event," Sue said. "All the protective beliefs that we'd held onto were shattered. There wasn't hate talk in our house. I'm part Jewish, and yet the anti-Semitic stuff was there. They were going through every derogatory word, a nigger, a kike. I saw the end product of my life's work. I had created a monster. Everything I had refused to believe was true. Dylan was a willing participant, and the massacre was not a spontaneous impulse. He had purchased and created weapons that were designed to end the lives of as many people as possible. He shot to kill. For the first time, I understood how Dylan appeared to others. When I saw his disdain for the world, I almost hated my son. I wanted to destroy the video that preserved him in that twisted and fierce mistake. From then on, no matter how lovingly he would be remembered by those who knew him, the tapes would provide a lasting contradiction to anything positive that could be said about his character. For me, it's a smothering emptiness. On these tapes, like the hope at the bottom of Pandora's box, is one moment of kindness. When Eric mentions their parents, Dylan says, "My parents have been good to me. I don't want to browse there." If you take Tom and Sue back to their pre-lapsarian memories, ease creeps into their voices. Dylan was a marvel, Tom recalled of his son's early childhood, completely self-motivated, curious. Every year on Dylan's birthday, Tom goes up to the place where the two used to hike and takes a Dr. Pepper, because Dylan loved Dr. Pepper and the stuffed koala that was Dylan's childhood favorite. The Klebolds needed 3 years to clean out Dylan's room and to remake it into the pleasant guest room in which I slept on my visits. Sue said, "He was a wonderful, marvelous, pretty close to perfect child. He made you feel like a great parent because he did everything right. Dylan had this incredible sense of organization and structure, and all this executive functioning. At 3, he could already count to 110, and would use refrigerator magnets to make equations. He entered preschool a year early, earned top grades, and was accepted to the Gifted Children program. When he was very young, he would dump 5 or 6 puzzles into a pile so he would have the thrill of working on them all at the same time. He liked mazes, he liked word searches, he played chess with Tom, he was just a delight. Sue looked at me sideways, then said quietly, "You can't imagine how long it's been since I had a chance to brag about my son." Later she said, "He was very malleable. You'd reason with him and say, 'This is why I think you should do something,' and you could almost always persuade him to change his mind, which I used to see as a strength from the perspective of a parent. But I see now that it might have been a terrible detriment." Only one incident with Dylan, the year before the massacre, suggested something might be amiss. The spring of his junior year, Dylan had asked to spend the night at his friend Zach's place, and when Zach had to cancel, Dylan took advantage and went driving with Eric. On their way to set off fireworks on a canyon road, they stopped at a parking lot and noticed a van with video equipment in the front seat. They grabbed a rock, broke the window, stole the equipment, then turned on their interior lights to inspect their haul. When a policeman stopped to see what was going on, Dylan confessed to the theft almost immediately, and both boys were taken to be booked. "The phone rings," Sue said. "It was the sheriff's department, the darkest night of our lives to that point." They went down to the station to find Dylan and Eric in handcuffs. The police released the boys back to their parents' custody and put them in a diversion program, which aims to help juveniles avoid a criminal record by assigning them community service, educational directives, and restitution. With hindsight, Sue believes that this putative act of mercy was a mean trick of fate. Had they gone to jail, the boys would have been separated and out of the school where they felt debased. The family didn't get home until dawn, and Sue was so angry she couldn't speak to Dylan. When Tom went for a walk the next day with Dylan, he was startled by his son's fury about the arrest. "He felt so above it all, totally justified in what he'd done," Tom said. "The morality of the whole thing escaped him." Sue noticed a similar attitude, and the diversion record remarks that he didn't connect to the wrongness of what he did. "I said, 'Dylan, help me understand this,'" Sue said. "How could you do something so morally wrong?" And he said, "Well, I didn't do it to another human being. It was to a company. That's what they have insurance for." And I said, "Dylan, you're scaring me." He said, "Well, it scared me too, because I don't know why I did it. Just suddenly, we'd done it." His mother chalked it up to teenage impulse and made him promise that he would never do anything of the sort again. He said, "I promise, but I'm scared, because I didn't know I was going to do it this time." So I said, "Well, now you know." Sue asked the people in the diversion program whether Dylan needed counseling, and they administered standardized psychological tests and found no indication that he was suicidal, homicidal, or depressed. "If I could say something to a room full of parents right now, I would say, 'Never trust what you see,'" Sue said. Was he nice? Was he thoughtful? "I was taking a walk not long before he died, and I'd asked him, 'Come and pick me up if it rains.' And he did. He was there for you, and he was the best listener I ever met. I realize now that that was because he didn't want to talk, and he was hiding." He and Eric worked together at the pizza parlor. A couple of weeks before Columbine, Eric's beloved dog was sick, and it looked like he wasn't going to make it. And so Dylan worked Eric's shift as well as his own so that Eric could have the time with his dog. In the writing Dylan and Eric left behind, Eric comes off as homicidal. His anger is all directed outward. Dylan comes off as suicidal. His energy fuels self-abnegation and self-criticism. It's as though Dylan went along with the homicide for Eric's sake, and Eric with the suicide for Dylan's. Toward the end, Dylan was counting the hours he had left. How could he keep it so secret, Sue wondered, this pain he was in? When I asked the Klebolds what they would want to ask Dylan if he were in the room with us, Tom said, I'd ask him what the hell he was thinking and what the hell he thought he was doing. Sue looked down at the floor for a minute before saying quietly, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head, for not being able to help him, for not being the person that he could confide in. Later she said, I've had thousands of dreams about Dylan, where I'm talking to him and trying to get him to tell me how he feels. I dreamed that I was getting him ready for bed, and I lifted up his shirt, and he was covered with cuts, and he was in all this pain, and I didn't see it. It was hidden. The Klebolds were caught in lawsuits brought by some victims' families. 4 years after the tragedy, they were deposed, supposedly confidentially, in front of these parents. The next day, the Denver paper contended that the world had a right to know what they had said. It was implying, after all that we'd been through, that they still believed we were at fault, Sue said. It was, how could you not know? How could you not know? And it's like, I can't answer that. I didn't know. I didn't know. I didn't know. How many times can you say that? Why would we have known and not gotten help, not told anyone? In the wake of so many enormous stresses, Sue was diagnosed with breast cancer. I don't believe in chakras, she said, but you think about all this heart pain and failed nurturing, and losing a child. I finally had an opportunity to meet some women who had lost children to suicide. There were 6 women, and 3 of us have had breast cancer. I used to laugh and say it was my version of comic relief, because after all we'd been through, the breast cancer seemed like sort of a nice, normal thing. For 2 years after the maelstrom of Columbine, she thought that she wanted to die, but now she was jarred into a new sense of purpose. It was like, wait a minute, I have something I have to do first. I have to explain who Dylan was and what he was like. I met a woman recently who had lost one son to suicide and whose other son was in jail, and I said to her, you can't appreciate or believe this now, but if you plunge deep into this, it will lead you to enlightenment. It's not the path you would have chosen, but it will make you a better and stronger person. After Columbine, Sue had a client who was blind, had only one hand, had just lost her job, and was facing trouble at home. She said, I may have my problems, but I wouldn't trade places with you for anything in the world. I laughed. All those years I've worked with people with disabilities and thought, thank God I can see, thank God I can walk, thank God I can scratch my head and feed myself. And I'm thinking, how funny it is, how we all use one another to feel better. Sue spoke of herself as a lucky person. I was fortunate that Dylan did not turn on us. The worst thing he did to us was he took himself away from us. After Columbine, I felt that Dylan killed God. No God could have had anything to do with this, so there must not be one. When everything in your world is gone, all your belief systems, and your self-concepts, your beliefs in yourself, your child, your family. There is a process of trying to establish, who am I? Is there a person there at all? A woman at work asked me recently how my weekend was, and it happened to be the anniversary of the shootings. So I said that I wasn't doing so well, and I told her why. And she said, I always forget that about you. I gave her a hug and said, that's the nicest thing anyone has said to me in years. But Sue does not forget. I sat next to someone on a train a while ago, and we had a really wonderful conversation. And then I could feel the questions coming. So how many kids do you have? I had to forestall it. I had to tell him who I was. And who I am forever now is Dylan's mother. When I mentioned to the Klebolds that I thought they spoke with an extraordinary clarity about their situation, in contrast to some of the other people I had interviewed for this chapter, Tom said, "We are able to be open and honest about those things because our son is dead. His story is complete. We can't hope for him to do something else, something better. You can tell a story a whole lot better when you know its ending." A few years after we first met, Sue said to me, "Way back when, we almost got a house in California, and our offer was turned down, and this house in Littleton came up. We made a low offer, and we were so thrilled when it was accepted. At the time, we said how lucky we were that the house in California hadn't worked out. But if it had, Columbine wouldn't have happened. When it first happened, I used to wish that I had never had children, that I had never married. If Tom and I hadn't crossed paths at Ohio State, Dylan wouldn't have existed, and this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. But over time, I've come to feel that, for myself, I am glad I had kids, and glad I had the kids I did, because the love for them, even at the price of this pain, has been the single greatest joy of my life. When I say that, I am speaking of my own pain, and not of the pain of other people. But I accept my own pain. Life is full of suffering, and this is mine. I know it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born. But I believe it would not have been better for me." Chapter 11. Transgender. Western culture likes binaries. Life feels less frightening when we can separate good and evil into tidy heaps, when we split off the mind from the body, when men are masculine and women are feminine. Threats to gender are threats to the social order. If rules are not maintained, everything seems to be up for grabs, and Joan of Arc must go to the stake. If we countenance people who want to chop off their penises and breasts, then what chance do we have of preserving the integrity of our own bodies? As the noted psychoanalyst Richard C. Friedman once joked, it might help if they all wore t-shirts that said, "Don't worry, it won't happen to you." Gender itself is a slippery concept. The author Amy Bloom says, "Male is not gay or straight, it's male. Neither the object of desire, nor the drinking of beer, nor the clenching of fists makes maleness. We don't know what does, and neither do transsexual men, and neither do the people who treat them, psychologically and surgically." But though gender is hard to define, it is not hard to know. Jan Morris, who wrote bravely of her transition, the process of switching gender, in the 1970s, has said, "Transsexualism is not a sexual mode or preference. It is not an act of sex at all. It is a passionate, lifelong, ineradicable conviction, and no true transsexual has ever been disabused of it. She explained, "My inner uncertainty could be represented in swirls and clouds of color, a haze inside me. I did not know exactly where it was, in my head, in my heart, in my loins, in my blood." The term transgender is an encompassing term that includes anyone whose behavior departs significantly from the norms of the gender suggested by his or her anatomy at birth. The term transsexual usually refers to someone who has had surgery or hormones to align his or her body with the non-birth gender. The term transvestite refers to someone who enjoys wearing clothing usually reserved for the other gender. Though the terms get used in a variety of ways, transgender and its abbreviation as trans are the most widely accepted in the trans community. A trans man was born female and became a man. A trans woman was born male and became a woman. Intersex describes people who are born with ambiguous genitalia or are in some other physical way both male and female from birth. It is a poverty of our language that we use the word sex to refer both to gender and to carnal acts, and from that unfortunate conflation springs much of the disgust around the notion of transgender children. Being trans is taken to be a depravity, and depravities in children are anomalous and disturbing. But trans children are not manifesting sexuality. They are manifesting gender. The issue is not whom they wish to be with, but whom they wish to be. As Aidan Key, a trans activist, put it, "My gender is who I am. My sexuality is who I bounce it off of." This is an essential distinction. Yet teasing out the complexities of transgender identity reveals how often these things can be confused, in a child, by a parent, and across the larger community. Gay and trans are separate categories, but a grayscale runs between them. Making the distinction is especially hard in childhood. A butch little girl or a feminine little boy may want to switch genders immediately, may develop that wish later, or may never develop it at all. One mother described being asked by a male friend whether her boyish daughter was gay and saying, "She's 4. I don't think she's got sexual desires yet." But such children may be demonstrating qualities associated with subsequent patterns of attraction. They may, in effect, be pre-gay, even if they haven't yet conceptualized the erotic. In 1987, Richard Green published his influential The Sissy Boy Syndrome and the Development of Homosexuality, in which he followed a cohort of 44 feminine little boys for 15 years. Only one transitioned. Most turned out simply to be gay. Sexuality and gender are independent yet entwined variables. Because cross-gender expression is much more common among gay people than it is among straight people, prejudice against such expression is a gay issue. Despite Jan Morris's assertion, gay too is an identity. Not something you do, but something you are. One can be gay despite never having had carnal relations with anyone of one's own gender. And one can be trans and have presented only in the gender one was assigned at birth. Those who are ignorant about homosexuality and transgender culture tend to confuse and conflate them with reason. Homophobia has always targeted gender nonconformity. Immeasurable differences exist between the outre gay guy who likes fashion and decorating magazines and the school football hero who happens to prefer sex with men. While the footballer may encounter legal challenges if he tries to marry a man, and may hear slurs from his teammates if they find out, he will not encounter the same day-to-day abuse that will likely make his classmates' life a living hell. The political liberty of transgender people has been ingrained in the battle for gay and lesbian rights. There are far more gay people than trans people, and the trans movement needs numbers behind it. But the conflation of the two issues nonetheless causes confusion. Some gay people think their trans brothers and sisters are in the same situation as themselves, only more so, and become passionate advocates on their behalf. Others find the trans community embarrassing and attempt to dissociate themselves, a pattern especially common among gay men who want to assert their masculinity credentials. The split echoes, in some ways, the split among early feminists about lesbians, with some viewing lesbianism as the ultimate expression of their identity, and others believing gay women would undermine their battle to ingratiate their ideals with the mainstream. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, intended to protect gay people from job discrimination, came before Congress in 2008 without any protection for gender expression. When the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force fought for a gender expression clause that would have prevented people from being denied employment or fired solely because they did not conform to gender type, they were told by Representative Barney Frank, who had introduced the bill, that they were asking for too much. Gender dissonance can manifest extremely early. By age 3 or 4, sometimes even younger, children may notice an incongruity between who they are told they are and who they sense they are. That discrepancy has been called gender identity disorder, or GID. In early childhood, gender nonconformity is often tolerated, but by 7 or so, children are pushed hard into gender stereotypes. Trans children may respond to such pressure by becoming anxious and depressed. Telling their parents is usually terrifying for them. If you don't let them transition, their internal energy is fully occupied with gender identity, and this keeps them from reaching their developmental markers, said Stephanie Brill, founder of the counseling entity Gender Spectrum, and author, with Rachel Pepper, of The Transgender Child. Often with transition, children's learning disabilities and other diagnoses resolve themselves, because the mind and heart are not so occupied with this central problem. Even 20 years ago, most transsexuals sought to move completely from one gender to the other. Nowadays, the categories are blurred. Some live stealth, meaning that everyone around them believes that they were born into the gender they inhabit. They feel they have failed when they are identified as their natal sex. Others live openly as trans men or trans women. Some spend some time stealth, and some openly trans. Some are genderqueer, identifying as neither male nor female. Others are gender fluid, male some days, female other days, and sometimes neither, or both. Some suffer from gender dysphoria, a deep misery about the body into which they were born. But others reject the darkness of that term. Some are exhibitionistic, and some extremely private. People in any of these categories may or may not have had surgery, be taking hormones, or have had a variety of other physical interventions. Collectively, they form what one author has called a gender chiaroscuro. The DSM says that 1 in 30,000 genetic males and 1 in 100,000 genetic females will undergo actual sex reassignment surgery in their lifetime. But such statistics would suggest that there are only 1,500 post-surgical trans men and 5,000 post-surgical trans women in the United States. The figures are based on antiquated surveys and reflect an extreme view of what constitutes reassignment surgery, not acknowledging, for example, that creating or removing breasts is a reassignment surgery even in the absence of genital procedures. Lynn Conway, a computer engineer who has analyzed more recent data, has estimated that there are between 32,000 and 40,000 post-operative trans women in the United States, but said that only 1 in 5 or 10 people who experiences intense discomfort with birth gender pursues genital surgery. The National Center for Transgender Equality estimates that for up to 3 million Americans, in Barbara Walters's phrase, what's between their legs doesn't match what's between their ears. Scientists, psychologists, clergy, and academics argue about whether bodies should be altered to accommodate minds or minds to accommodate bodies. Some believe that all people who vary from gender norms can, with psychiatric treatment, live contentedly in their birth gender. They prescribe a broad range of reparative therapies to address the mind-body dissonance. Others presume that the role of medicine is to facilitate transition and believe in using hormones and surgery to do so. Parents are in a bind, familiar throughout this book, between cure and acceptance. Advocates for reparative therapy insist that people live better in unmutilated bodies, and that medical corrections involving considerable pain, risk, and expense should be options of last resort. Opponents contend that strict gender rules are archaic and punitive, and that discouraging transgender people from inhabiting their real selves is a prescription for despair, often for suicide. Received wisdom is evolving at a breakneck pace. The social model of disability, that the problems trans people have are the result largely of the social attitudes they encounter, is argued here with particular ferocity. Parents who support their child's transition, the shift away from a natal gender, must refer to that child by a new name. They must use new pronouns, and they must switch the words son and daughter. Linguistic chaos often ensues. "He's my daughter," one mother explained to me as she introduced her transgender son. Another said, "I used the word child because I cannot wrap my mind around daughter, even though I am fine calling my child Elaine." Sociologist Holly DeVore writes, "In those cases where persons were living as men at the time of their interviews, but were talking about events lived as girls or women, I have used feminine pronouns. For example, he remembered that as a girl she had been a tomboy." How we name something determines how we perceive it. Most of the trans people I met disliked MTF, for male to female, and FTM, female to male, feeling that these terms demean the people to whom they are applied. Many activists speak of people having been declared male or declared female at birth, and later becoming affirmed females or affirmed males. Trans people often refer to the non-trans population as cisgender, borrowing the idea from the cis-trans distinction in chemistry. The Latin prefix cis means on the same side. I have chosen to refer to people by natal gender prior to transition and by affirmed gender after transition, and to impose this on my interviews with families as much as possible. In cases where people prefer that their pre-transition name be forgotten, I have consistently used the post-transition name. 27 weeks pregnant as a single mother, Vanessa Romero was rushed to a Denver hospital, where she gave birth to a girl and a boy. The girl looked fairly strong, but the boy was less than a pound and a half and covered with fuzz, his organs visible through his unformed skin. Premature babies are given pulmonary surfactants, which help them to breathe. Because the girl was stronger, they treated her first. She had an adverse reaction and died within minutes. The boy survived. Within a year, Vanessa met and married Joseph Romero, an Air Force sergeant. The baby's father had never even seen him. Joseph adopted him and changed his name to Joseph Romero II, called Joey. When the baby was 20 months old, the family was posted to the U.S. Air Force Base in Okinawa. The baby would cry all the time, Joseph recalled. But not, I want food, I want to be changed. It wasn't a physical need, and we had no way to console him. The temper tantrums were so bad that we couldn't take him out in public. Over the next 4 years, Joey was diagnosed with ADHD, depression, anxiety, attachment disorder, and asthma. At 3, he was on 14 different medications. We had a child who never smiled, Vanessa said. All the time we were cooing, oh, you're such a good boy, such a beautiful boy. Boy, boy, boy. Every time I put shoes on him, there were little boy's shoes, a little boy's jacket. Joey was already interested in wearing girlish outfits. Vanessa thought he was probably gay, and worried about how that would go with her military husband. The Romeros had access only to military doctors, who were cautious of a diagnosis that the military does not welcome. But one finally told Vanessa, when Joey was 5, to look up GID online. It was making him squirm just to say that, like his rank was going to fall off, Vanessa said. I had never even heard the word transgender. I was hugely relieved. Other people go through this? The internet introduces trans people and their families into instant networks that can provide information and support. It likewise offers misinformation. Online spaces created to shield and help trans children can easily become the locus of predators with disturbing erotic fantasies, or of transphobic people with murderous intentions. In this instance, however, Kim Pearson, herself the mother of a transgender child and one of the founders of Trans Youth Family Allies, TYFA, a group that supports families addressing gender variance, found Vanessa online. She carried me to a forum with other parents, Vanessa said. I cried with gratitude. The revelation threw Joseph into an abrupt and severe depression. Vanessa started to call their child Josie. Josie wouldn't go outside unless she could go in her girl clothes. I had to decide then, was I willing to leave my marriage to protect Josie? Well, to make Josie be a boy is asking her to commit suicide. I'm not that kind of parent. By this time, Vanessa and Joseph had adopted a younger daughter, Jade, from China. I'm willing to give Joseph up, and I'm willing to walk away from Jade, which was incredibly hard. But Josie was 5, and had already paid enough penance for 10 lives. While Vanessa was making these calculations, her husband gradually came around. She had that sparkle, he said. I just decided, Josie is here to stay. When I first met Josie, she was 8, and she said, I'm a girl, and I have a penis. They thought I was a boy until I was 6. I dressed like a girl. I said, I'm a girl. They didn't understand for the longest time. Josie was increasingly assertive about her need to be a girl all the time. So one day Joseph agreed to take her to school on the base in a denim skirt with a pink rabbit on it and pink leggings underneath. The kids were mostly accepting, but their parents were another story. The next day, there was a screaming crowd outside Josie's classroom door, Vanessa said. I was terrified. In Josie's own yard, someone snatched her bicycle from her and tossed it into the jungle. P People were throwing things at our house, calling us child molesters, Vanessa said. Little girls screaming, "You're a fucking faggot!" The wife of the Judge Advocate General on base started a petition to remove Josie from school. "It was awful when everyone found out I was a girl," Josie remembered. "My neighbor Isabel said she was going to call the police and put me in jail. It made me sad. I thought she was my friend." Vanessa allowed Josie to choose her clothes, and every day she shunned the boy clothes. "She wouldn't go outside without a skirt on," Vanessa said, "but she's got the biggest smile on her face." "Well, I'm going to smile, too." So I did. I was holding her hand tighter than usual, but she just kept on marching. Before long, Vanessa and Joseph had taken her off all her medications. Her asthma, depression, anxiety, and attachment disorder were all gone. But the military told the family to get out of Okinawa, claiming they could not protect Josie. They were reassigned to a base in the Arizona desert. Vanessa didn't want Josie at another military school. She located a public school in Tucson with a liberal-leaning principal and enrolled both daughters. But Josie's teacher refused to call her by a female name and told Josie that Vanessa was a mean mommy who was forcing her to live as a girl when everyone could see she was a boy. "She was an awful, rude teacher who didn't want me at her school," Josie said. "I got so angry and frustrated." Vanessa said, Josie's self-esteem was crushed. She was back to being gloomy. Josie complained of stomach aches and headaches and fought every day against going to school, which began sending truancy notices. The Romeros moved to another town. Fearing for Josie's safety, they installed alarm wiring on the windows and doors and bought a Great Dane to intimidate attackers. Vanessa sent an email to the principal of the local public school that began, "I'm the proud mother of an 8-year-old transgender daughter." His head of human resources said, "We follow state laws, and there are no anti-discrimination protections for your child here." In November, Vanessa placed her daughters at a Waldorf school, but at $20,000 per year, it was impossible on an Air Force salary. The only option left was homeschooling. Josie said, "I miss going out." Joseph said, "The isolation is the price we pay to shield her from a world that could harm her." Isolation is not the only difficulty. "I always have the penis problem," Josie said. "I want to get rid of it, but I think it will hurt. They said I have to be a certain age to take my penis off, when I'm more like 15. Vanessa said, 18. "But you'll be able to take estrogen and grow boobs sooner than that." Josie explained, "When I'm a mommy, I'll adopt my babies, but I'll have boobies to feed them, and I will wear a bra, dresses, skirts, and high-heeled shoes." She seemed equally definite when she told me that she wanted to marry someone with rainbow-colored hair who was beautiful on the inside and the outside. "We'll get a baby here in Arizona and then go live in whatever state Jade is in so we can be next-door neighbors," Josie said. "We'll live in a treehouse. I'll grow my hair all the way to California." Later, Vanessa said to me, "I wouldn't put Josie through surgery until she was emotionally ready for the physical pain. But if she were, I would absolutely do it right now." Vanessa plans to give Josie puberty blockers, which stop the production of testosterone and estrogen. "She won't have testosterone ravaging her body," Vanessa said, "so she'll never get an Adam's apple or facial hair. She'll never look like a man in a dress." Vanessa found a doctor in Tucson who was willing to work on this protocol. Joseph persuaded the Department of Records to issue a new birth certificate for Josie, with her correct name and gender. But Vanessa also deliberately kept toys for boys around the house, saying, "I don't want her to feel like she's proving she's a girl by playing with Barbies all the time." Most trans children I encountered were living stealth. I was struck that many of these kids had gone from one discrepancy, living in an anatomical gender that was anathema to them, to another, living in a gender that did not match their body. Josie's openness had come at high cost, but she struck me as more truly free than many other trans children. Josie has become an activist. It's a hard role to imagine for someone who is 8 and still thinks she may live in a treehouse, but this strange jumble of hypermaturities and childishness was her core. When I met her, she had just been filmed by National Geographic for her second documentary. She has met with members of Congress and the governor of Arizona. I wondered to what degree Joseph and Vanessa shared, or indeed manufactured, this activist bent. But Vanessa, who had considered the wisdom of having her daughter stealth at least in some contexts, asked rhetorically, "What's the first thing Josie says?" "Hi, my name is Josie. I'm 8. I am transgender. Who are you?" In 2009, Kim Pearson, by then a friend of the family, was chosen for a community service award, but was unable to attend the ceremony. She asked Josie to accept the award on her behalf. 700 people were in the audience. "She turns to me on the podium," Vanessa remembered. She whispered, "Mommy, I have really big stage frightfulness right now." But she whispered right into the microphone. Everyone laughed, and that relaxed her. Josie ad-libbed her speech and got a standing ovation. "Josie's very fragile, very emotional," Vanessa said. "But Josie wants to change the world." Vanessa noted, "Little boys don't go around saying they're little girls without good reason. They're trusting you to listen, and we didn't know how." The other day she said, "Mommy, why did you want me to be a boy?" That killed me. I told her, "I didn't understand, and I'm really sorry." She said, "It's okay, Mommy. I love you, and everything's so good now." Gender is among the first elements of self-knowledge. This knowledge encompasses an internal sense of self, and often, a preference for external behaviors such as dress and type of play. Gender identity's etiology, however, posited to lie in genetics, in uterine androgen levels, in early social influences, remains obscure. Pino Meyer-Balberg, a professor of psychology at Columbia University who specializes in gender variance, has described numerous possible biological mechanisms and said that as many as 400 rare genes and epigenetic phenomena may be involved, genes associated not with hormone regulation, but with personality formation. "The view we have of the brain now is like those wonderful pictures of Earth that the first astronauts took from the moon," said Norman Spack, associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard University and a leading endocrinologist in the field. "You can see the continents, the oceans, the weather systems. When you can read the license plates, we'll know what causes gender nonconformity." Like autism, gender nonconformity seems far more prevalent than ever before. As with autism, whether the condition is actually more frequent or simply more recognized is unclear. The non-genetic biological arguments are confusing. The synthetic estrogen diethylstilbestrol, DES, developed in 1938 and used until the early 1970s to prevent miscarriage, has had many adverse effects on both males and females exposed to it in utero. A 2002 survey of members of the DES Sons Network found an extraordinary 50% rate of transgenderism. This supports the hypothesis that gestational hormone levels can trigger cross-gender identity. Scientists have also expressed concern about endocrine disruptors, EDCs, a class of chemicals found in everything from food to floor polish to packing materials. EDCs are known to be responsible for an increasing incidence of deformities in amphibian reproductive systems. Researchers have speculated that they might be responsible for the increasing incidence of genital abnormalities and atypical gender identity in human beings. In 1991, Georges Canguilhem, a historian of science who worked on the concept of mutation, wrote, "Diversity is not disease. The anomalous is not the pathological." Being trans is without question anomalous. The relentlessly debated question is whether it is also pathological. Gender identity disorder was introduced as a medical category in 1980. The DSM-IV requires that 4 of the following 5 symptoms be present for a diagnosis in children: strong and persistent cross-gender identification, designed as the desire to be, or the insistence that one is, of the other sex; persistent discomfort about one's assigned sex or a sense of inappropriateness in the gender role of that sex, often manifested in cross-dressing of some kind; an inclination toward cross-sex roles in make-believe play, with fantasies of being the other sex; a constant wish to participate in the stereotypical games and pastimes of the other sex; a preference for playmates of the other sex. Boys diagnosed with GID commonly prefer feminine clothing and hairstyles, often are mothers when they play house, avoid rough-and-tumble play and athletics, and are interested in female fantasy figures such as Snow White. Girls diagnosed with GID often have intensely negative responses to being asked to wear dresses, prefer short hair, are often mistaken for boys, seek out rough-and-tumble play, enjoy sports, and choose fantasy figures such as Batman. In an age when women can work in construction and men can marry other men, the notion of a medically enshrined Batman versus Snow White typology of gender identity seems reductive, yet it still has considerable currency in the medical literature. The diagnosis is specified as inapplicable to anyone with an intersex condition. Whereas most children will play at an early age with toys suitable to either gender, trans kids often refuse the toys associated with their natal sex. Meyer-Balberg describes these children as pervasively gender atypical from birth. A scale of gendered behavior ranks people as very masculine at one end and very feminine at the other. Typical boys are 3.5 to 5 standard deviations in the direction of masculinity, and the girls are the same number of deviations toward femininity. But trans kids will tend to be 7 to 12 deviations from the norm in the direction away from their birth gender. In other words, natal males become more female than most females, while natal females become more male than most males. "It's almost like their play is a political statement," Spack said. Adults with GID show clinically significant distress or impairment in social and occupational functioning. Some children who have gone undiagnosed will manifest the syndrome during puberty or afterward. Conversely, only a quarter of children given a GID diagnosis will show full cross-gender identification in adolescence. In other words, sometimes their play means nothing about their future identity, and sometimes It means everything. This is why decisions about how to raise them are so fraught. Many professionals who work with trans children believe that the society at large is failing them. Kelly Winters, founder of GID Reform Advocates,